Hello, hello, hello. I have been looking forward to this for quite some time, and I hope that I can give you some good thoughts to think about. God is the most important thing in the universe, and so we want to make sure that we are in a proper relationship with Him, and that, as our brother Scott has shared with us, that we find our great achievement of our potential that God has given to us. We have great potential in a relationship with God. And oftentimes people think about boundaries as being confining, but I would suggest to you that those are enhancing in many ways, just like our brother said. We tend to follow God's way, then that's the best way, because He has designed us. You probably have heard something along the lines of science has disproven God, or science has made God irrelevant. Because of the advent of science, God is now viewed as being dead. For about the past 200 years or so, that has been eroded away and away and away. But as our brother again, Scott, said to you all just a few moments ago, when we do science, we should see God. We should see His fingerprints all over what we study. In Hebrews chapter 3 and verses 3 and 4, there's an interesting statement that I think furnishes us with a good illustration that we're going to use throughout our lesson today. And that is this idea that science is a tool. Science is a tool. I, like Scott, did not grow up in a religious household. I was not really, I don't think I ever studied the Bible with my parents in my childhood or adult life, unfortunately. My dad has since passed. I've tried to open that door with my mom, haven't gotten very far with that. But I keep trying, and I would encourage you to keep trying to influence and bring others to God as well. So my dad was a builder years ago. I'm from Michigan, and my dad was a builder, and oftentimes what he built were things like decks and houses, the typical things that you would think. And one of his favorite tools, one of my favorite tools, one of the things that makes me think about my dad is a hammer. And so I'm going to use the idea of a hammer and connect science to a hammer throughout this lesson. In Hebrews chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, it tells us, For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has much honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now, the great thing about houses is we know that they're built by somebody. We do not have to be there for their building. If you walk by a 100-year-old house, you probably can come to a very firm conclusion that it was built by somebody. And that's the point of the Hebrews writer right here, that every house has a builder, and the builder of all things is God. He is the great contractor. He is the one who doesn't take your money and run. He's the one that doesn't give you a lemon of a house. He's the one that does things right. And so we're going to use this idea of contracting or building, and specifically the idea of a tool. And that's what science is. Science is a tool. But as you probably know about tools, not every tool is good for everything that you need to do. And some tools are better than others for certain things. So when we think about science as a tool, we're going to use this hammer illustration. A tool, or a hammer, for example, can be used correctly or incorrectly. I can hammer a nail correctly, or I can hammer it incorrectly. And if I use it incorrectly, I know very quickly, because what happens? I smash my finger. And if you have ever installed siding, for instance, or helped your parents install siding, it is notorious for smashing your fingers. And you probably will learn over time that it's best to use a hammer the correct way. But sometimes hammers can be used incorrectly. A hammer also can have a certain range of use. If I am tightening a bolt on my car, a hammer is not very good for that. And so science is much the same way when we think about God, especially that it has a certain range of use. It can be used for some things, but it's not very useful for other things. And that's okay to say. Hammers are well suited for some tasks, and they are ill suited for other tasks. And so again, thinking about science as a tool for understanding God, you have the same basic things that can be said. Science can be used correctly or incorrectly. Again, you probably have heard the idea that science has disproven God. I would suggest to you that that is an incorrect use of science, and it hurts just as much as an incorrect use of hammer would hurt you. It has a certain range of use, and Ryan's going to come up after me, and he's going to talk about how things like the cosmological argument and the teleological argument are fine, but they're also limited. And so we get to things like the ontological argument, which he's probably going to talk a little bit about. Science, when we're thinking about God, is well-suited for some tasks, and it's ill-suited for others. It, again, has a limited range. But you think about the past 200 years, and some people have said that science has disproven God, but oftentimes, in fact, I would suggest to you the majority of science for hundreds of years was used to try and understand that God did create. How he created was what drove science forward during the Renaissance and after that. So we have people from the past 200 years that have used science as a tool for understanding God. And we could go all day and all night. We could talk about Galileo. We could talk about all sorts of other scientists. But I'm just going to give you three. One from about 200 years ago was when he was born. This man was named Louis Pasteur. Has anybody heard of Louis Pasteur? Really instrumental in the development of vaccines, really instrumental in pasteurization. And what do we pasteurize things for? What do we mainly pasteurize? Anybody sat at the breakfast table and read your jug of milk? It's pasteurized, right? And so we think about him. He studied bacteria was his number one thing. He said, a little science estranges or separates man from God, but much science leads them back to him. And so oftentimes, again, an incorrect use of science, I think, would lead somebody away. A superficial incorrect use of science would lead people away from God. But I think a deep understanding of God would enrich faith. And that's what we're looking to today. That's why I've been invited, right, Mark and David, is to give us something to enrich and invigorate our faith, to give us a realization that we need God and that it is reasonable to believe in God. Anybody ever heard of Albert Einstein? Now, this is one of the more glamorous shots that you see of him. Normally, he's got that wacky, crazy hair. He's sticking his tongue out, and he's kind of a fun guy. But he was obviously a very smart, intelligent man. He lived not quite as long ago as Louis Pasteur. You know, his heyday was like in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, around World War I and World War II. He said, science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. He wrote that in an essay on science and its relationship to belief in God, theism in a general sense. Now, somebody today would be somebody like James Torr. James Torr is a nanotechnologist. Can somebody tell me what a nanotechnologist does? Study small things, small things. And what he particularly works with, I believe, is eyes, trying to think about eyes and how fast they can register certain things. Right, Scott? Trying to understand that. And he says this very strongly. He says, only a rookie who knows nothing about science would say science takes away from faith. If we really study science, it will bring you closer to God. So we have these scientists, some of the most influential scientists of all time, saying, no, science has not disproven God. What science does is it enriches our understanding of God. This is different from what we normally hear. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But what we're going to do today is not survey a history of science, but we're going to give you a few tools to try and help enrich and invigorate your faith, how we can understand God's, not only his existence, not only the fact that there is, generally speaking, a God over the universe, but how we get to the God of the Bible. And our first tool here, we'll call this the sledgehammer tool. What's a sledgehammer used for? Breaking stuff, right? You guys ever watch Fixer Upper, Chip and Joanna Gaines? What's Chip's favorite day? Demo day! He wants to smash things. You know, he's got his little hammer, his kind of normal claw hammer, but then he's got that big sledgehammer, right? And to me, I think this cosmological argument is the sledgehammer tool. That if we're going to be using tools, I think this is the sledgehammer tool. This is how you break open the door. This is how you get the old stuff out. You think about cause and effect. And if you don't like pronouncing that word cosmology, just think cause and effect. That's the idea that we're thinking about here. Francis Bacon, you may have heard of him. He's commonly referred to as the father of modern science. He talked about science, and he said that science is the knowledge of causes, trying to understand causes. That was all of what he was about. He was also a pioneer of the scientific method. Has anybody here ever studied in your science class the scientific method? Right, you form a hypothesis, and basically you test the hypothesis, and you record your results. So he's a big pioneer for that as well. And he incorporated this relationship into what has basically become the pattern of science, what's become the paradigm of science, studying cause and effect. Science is, I would say to you, first and foremost about observing and understanding and measuring and recording the relationship between cause and effect. Would you agree with that? That's what we do in science, right? So let me give you three illustrations of this. Now, science, if we wanted to kind of give a general understanding of it, science looks like this. If blank happens, then blank will result. If blank happens, then blank will not result. So three examples here. What happens when we heat the air inside of a balloon? It's on the screen. It inflates, right? It inflates. There's a reason for that, because when you heat particles up, what happens to them? They move faster. The faster they move when you heat them up. If you cool them down, what happens? They move slower, right? So if you heat up air inside of a balloon, say you're in a hot air balloon, which is insane that anybody would ever go into a hot air balloon. But say you're in a hot air balloon. What do they use to keep that hot air balloon up in the air? They heat it, right? They've got a torch that heats the air inside of this. What happens if the torch stops working? You're going down, which is why it's crazy to go into a hot air balloon. So if you heat the air inside of a balloon, then it will inflate. I'll give you another illustration of this. If I have this beautiful gold bar, this like $10,000 gold bar, if I smack it with a hammer, what happens? It's going to dent, it's going to scuff, probably not break the gold bar because gold's pretty solid, but gold is also pretty soft. And so I would scuff it up. And here's my favorite illustration from science of all time. If I throw a rotten tomato at Mark McCrary's head, then he will be angry at me. Now, technically, this is an untested hypothesis, but we could test it. Does anybody want to test that? He probably would be upset. Now, David raised his hand. What if we switched this? What if we said, let's throw a rotten tomato at David's head? What do you think his response is going to be? He's pretty passive. He'd probably be like, what are you doing? Mark might come up to me and be like, hey, buddy. So even then, that's pretty much, we wouldn't even necessarily have to test that, right? I mean, that's pretty clear cut. That's a well-formed hypothesis. You throw a rotten tomato at somebody's head, they're going to be upset with you. So three basic illustrations there. It was cause and effect. Cause and effect really is what science is, I would say, all about. And ultimately, what we're doing with this tool, this sledgehammer to open the door to God, is what we're trying to do is we're trying to make a case for God as the uncaused cause. There has to be a starting point, in other words. And the classic illustration of this is dominoes. But who plays dominoes anymore? I mean, really? But we all get the idea. You play it? Okay, so you guys get it, right? So, dominoes. So you stack up dominoes, and what's the goal? To make the biggest line, and to make a really cool design. You might make like a really neat design. But ultimately, what are you going to do? Not just make a neat design, what are you going to do? You're going to knock it down. And so if I was to walk into a room and there's dominoes that are falling, what can I conclude? Somebody knocked the first one over. Now you could take that all the way back. You could say, well, I could conclude that there's also somebody who stacked the dominoes up. I could conclude that there's such thing as dominoes. There's somebody who made dominoes. You know, there's a lot of ways that you could go back to it. That's a classic illustration of this, though. A couple of scriptures that tie us to this, that anchor us to this idea, and tell us that the God of the universe is the uncaused cause. John chapter 1 and verse 3, speaking of Jesus as the Word of God, the Logos of God, says all things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. So he is the one who started it all. Somebody may ask the question, who started God? What started God? And that's a classic response to the cosmological argument. And so I think we have to be careful about the way that we phrase this. All things that have come into being have a cause. That's science. Colossians chapter 1, talking about Jesus again, and using this sort of cause and effect language. Colossians 1 and verse 15 says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, or the preeminent one of all creation is another way of saying that. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is also head of the body of the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, being or having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I said, whether things on earth or things in heaven. So all things have been created by him, except what? It's kind of implied here in the language, except the one who created those things. So God doesn't have a creator. So we might have to be careful about how we structure this. Sometimes people have made really bad cause and effect arguments. And I would suggest to you that one of the better ones out there, maybe not the best, but one of the better ones that's become very popular, is by a guy named William Lane Craig. And he invented this idea of the kalam cosmological argument, is what he calls it. So it's this idea. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Things don't come into being from nothing, right? I mean, you guys have come into being that had a cause. This building has been erected, built. It had a cause. Is anybody here when this building was built? One person, Mark. Okay, so Mark tells you, hey, somebody was building this. There was a whole crew of people that built this. Nobody else was here. Do you believe him? Would it be reasonable to believe that? Not only is it reasonable, but could you get around that? Could you say that, well, maybe it was a tornado that passed through a nearby junkyard that created this building? Would you believe that? So sometimes things are inescapable, and that's kind of the idea here. The second idea, the universe began to exist. And there's a lot of really good reasons for that. The red tint, for instance, that we see in our space telescopes. Good, solid evidence for that, that there was a starting point. Now, if you get rid of God, what's the starting point that people typically argue? The Big Bang Theory. Now, let me ask you something. Have you ever seen an explosion? Maybe the 4th of July, right? Firecracker. Would you want to hold that explosion in your hand? Why not? Destroys. That's what explosions do. Let me ask you a question. The bigger the explosion, what happens? You get more damage. Now, I think we've had enough time since I was a kid, but when I was a kid, somehow my dad got a stick of dynamite. Dynamite's fun. And so he ended up putting it out in our driveway. We had a limestone driveway. I don't recommend doing this at home, but we had a limestone driveway. It's made up of little rocks. And he blew up that stick of dynamite. Now, that was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. Because I was like a teenage boy, and it was spectacular. But he blew it up. And what do you think it did to our driveway? It made my mom very angry. Because that's what explosions do. Have you ever in your life seen an explosion create order? Well, isn't that what science is? Isn't science observation and testing? Have you ever seen an explosion create order? Now, it doesn't matter if it's in a watch factory, it doesn't matter if it's anywhere, it doesn't matter, because what is inescapable is that when things have order, then they have a cause. They have somebody who's ordered it. And 1 Corinthians chapter 14 tells us that our God is not a God of chaos and disorder. He's a God of order, and obviously using that in the context of worship. 3, a cause of the universe exists. That's kind of the conclusion that we draw out of this. And then you think about what it means to be a cause of space and time, matter and energy, and what that brings you to is a beginningless, uncaused, timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful personal creator of the universe, and that is the very core concept of God. When we study theology in the Bible, that's what we see. In the book of Revelation, for instance, God says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. In the book of Isaiah, God says, you do not know what happens beforehand, but I do, because I am different. In Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And because of what we see, we can go back to our uncaused cause. That's what Francis Bacon called science. Now, we can spend a lot more time on that, but we're going to go to a second tool. We're going to call this the claw hammer approach. The claw hammer approach. So we had our sludge hammer. That's kind of how you bust the door in demo day. The claw hammer is a little more special because it's going to be a little bit closer, but people can misuse claw hammers and you can smash your little fingers up with claw hammers. But we're going to call this the intelligent design tool. Intelligent design is kind of the newer way of referring to something that's been around for a long time. In times past, it's been referred to as teleology. Technically, the cosmological argument and the teleological argument, our first 2 points here, fall under something called natural theology. It's using nature to argue for God. But lately, this has been called the intelligent design tool. And our first tool we called cause and effect. Our second tool, we're going to say that this is the observation tool. Science is all about observation. And the classic way of approaching this was by a guy 220 years ago, a guy by the name of William Paley, made kind of an illustration of a watch. Now, if somebody was writing today, they probably would use the illustration of like an iPhone. What are we on now? Like 27? What's the newest iPhone? 14. So the iPhone 14. So you're walking through the woods one day, and you see an iPhone 14 on the ground. What do you conclude about that iPhone 14? Somebody dropped it. Now, we don't have to do anything really as fancy as that. If I see a sheet of paper out in the woods with lines on it, what do I conclude about that? Somebody dropped it. And it doesn't have to be as advanced as like an iPhone 14, but that is kind of what we see when we observe things in nature. So I'll read this to you. It's probably a little small for you to read. It may be in your notes. I think it may be in your notes. I'm not sure. But this is the argument that he makes. And there's two components to this. The idea of walking in the woods, and he's comparing a stone that he finds along the path to a watch that he finds along the path. When we come to inspect the watch, we perceive what we could not discover in the stone, that its several parts are framed and put together for a purpose, that they are so formed and adjusted as to produce motion, and that motion is so regulated as to point out the hour of the day. That's purpose. That if the different parts had been differently shaped from what they are, or of a different size from what they are, or placed after any other manner or in any other order than that in which they are placed, either no motion at all would have been carried on in the machine, or none which would have answered the use that is now served by it. The conclusion which the first examination of the watch of its works, construction, and movement suggested was that it must have had for the cause and author of that construction an artificer, so a maker, a watchmaker, who understood its mechanism and designed its use. This conclusion is invincible. And again, it's a pretty straightforward approach. You're walking in the woods, you find something, you know it's designed, different than a rock. If I find a rock, it might be kind of an interesting shaped rock. It might have some moss on there that looks like the Virgin Mary. But that's a subjective approach, right? This is an irrefutable and invincible approach. And nobody really has done a great job of arguing against Paley in this approach. And he brings up a second point, though, in his kind of introduction to this argument. He says, now you look at it again, because that's what science does. You look at things multiple times. So you look at it again. In this second examination, this presents us with a new discovery. The watch is found in the course of its movement to produce another watch, similar to itself. And of course, he's getting beyond the watch now, and he's using this as an illustration. Not only so that we perceive in it a system or organization separately calculated for that purpose, what effect would this discovery have or ought it to have upon our former inference? What, as hath already been said, but to increase beyond measure our admiration of the skill which has been employed in the formation of such a machine? Or shall it instead of this all at once turn us round to an opposite conclusion, namely that no art or skill whatever has been concerned in the business, although all other evidences of art and skill remain as they were, and this last and supreme piece of art be now added to the rest? Can this be maintained without absurdity? Yet this is atheism. This is atheism, for every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design, which existed in the watch, exists in the works of nature, with the difference on the side of nature of being greater and more, and that in a degree which exceeds all computation. I mean that the contrivances of nature surpass the contrivances of art in the complexity, subtlety, and curiosity of the mechanism, and still more, if possible, do they go beyond them in number and variety, yet in a multitude of cases are not less evidently mechanical, not less evidently contrivances, not less evidently accommodated to their end or suited to their office than are the most perfect productions of human ingenuity. So he wrote this 220 years ago. Now, science has moved forward, and we've developed lots of different tools since then. We have things like electron microscopes. We have satellites that fly way deep into space and give us these really cool pictures of things out there in space. So we have advanced since then. But again, nobody's really overturned that argument. That argument has stood the tests of time. Now, people have tried to contest this, and one of the main arguments is that in this book that William Paley wrote, he can be a little subjective in his application of this argument. Just because something's cool doesn't mean it has a designer. There may be some interesting moss on a rock, but that doesn't mean that there was an artist out in the forest carving up that moss. But really, the core argument itself has never really been overturned. So what we do with this, as believers, is we argue from design. We argue from design, and what that does is it gives us access to objective data, whereby we can begin to understand God's creation. And when we understand God's creation, that helps us to understand Him. Michael Behe is a research biochemist. He's written a few books. Darwin Devolves is his newest one, I believe. And then before that, we have Darwin's Black Box. Really smart guy. He said the conclusion of intelligent design flows naturally from the data itself, not from sacred books or sectarian beliefs. The reluctance of science to embrace the conclusion of intelligent design has no justifiable foundation. Many people, including many important and well-respected scientists, just don't want there to be beyond nature. Now, that's not really science. That's, you know, just because I don't want something to be the case, that doesn't make it so. So what we do with design is we look at a couple different things. We look at what we'll call the signature of design, and that's like finding an iPhone out in nature. I don't have to bring that back to a laboratory and do a bunch of testing on it. I know by the fact that there's an iPhone 14 in nature that somebody made it. It's a signature of design. Then we have something like irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity has to do with like systems, a lot of things in order. If you take out one piece of it, it messes up. So has anybody ever opened up like the back of a watch or looked inside at like a grandfather clock and you see all the different gears moving together? What happens if I take one of those gears out? It doesn't work. Now, I may modify and change it to try and get it to work, but if I take out that gear from that system, it doesn't work. That's what happens a lot of times in nature. You take one thing out and it messes everything up. Then we have something called specified complexity. So it doesn't just get the job done, it gets the job done usually pretty well. It's specifically designed for that purpose. And then fine-tuning. Fine-tuning. Does anybody know what a Ducati is? Ducati motorcycle? You know, Scott. So a Ducati is very well tuned. What about a Ferrari? Now, in a race, I have a Toyota Corolla, 2005 Toyota Corolla with like 150,000 miles out in the parking lot. Let's say I line up against that Ferrari. Who's going to win? I'm going to get blown out of the water. I love my little Corolla. I like zipping around town in it. But I'm going to be blown out of the water. Why? Because that Ferrari has been specifically fine-tuned to output a lot more horsepower and a lot more torque than my little Corolla. Now, my little Corolla, I could probably top out at about 110. Not that I've ever tried that. But that's about as much as I could top out at. A Ferrari will pull about 200 miles an hour. Pretty easy, because it's been designed that way. And that's what we see in the Bible. We can build what the Bible writers would call an ironclad case for God based on that. Remember Hebrews 3, every house has a builder. The builder of all things is God. It's unavoidable that you would come to that conclusion. There's other passages that talk about this, though, too. Psalm 8. Somebody want to read Psalm 8 for me? It's short. It's not like Psalm 119. I'll call on somebody. Who wants to do it? Psalm 8. Gabriel, how about you, buddy? Can you read Psalm 8? Somebody else? Okay. Psalm 8. Go ahead. Okay, so this is Natural Theology 101. This is looking at nature and trying to understand God. So in verse 3, it says, when I consider your heavens, when I observe, when I study these things, and the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is the man that you take thought of him, the son of man that you are mindful of him? Sometimes we have this idea that David's just kind of sitting on the couch and somebody's feeding him grapes and, you know, the palm fronds and everything. He's just sitting there, he's like, well, that's pretty cool to think about. No, I mean, David, remember, his son is Solomon, and what does it say about Solomon? He studied plants, and he studied animals, he imported gorillas and apes, he did all kinds of these sorts of things. Where do you think he got that knowledge from? Maybe his mom, but maybe a little bit of his dad, too. And so this idea of pondering or considering is probably more than just, oh, that's pretty neat. He says it is beyond computation that I could even sit here and think about how wonderfully complex this universe is and all that you have done. That's the same argument in Psalm 19. It says, the heavens are telling of the glory of God and their expanses, declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterances to the end of the world. In them he has placed a tent for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It rejoices as a strong man to run his course. Its rising is from one end of the heavens, and a circuit to the other end of them. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. Now, this is definitely somebody who has thought about nature. Somebody who has recognized, hey, the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west. And we have a day that is structured and understandable. The heavens are telling us this. Who in the world cannot see the stars? Well, really nobody. I mean, even if you live in a place where there's all kinds of pollution, you're going to see some stars. You might not see as many stars. You may have to go out to the country. But anybody in the world can see these sorts of things. Anybody in the world can see the sun rise and the sun set. That's the point of Psalm 19. It's irrefutable proof. In Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18, it tells us that God designed this world for us to live in and use it. He specifically did that. Remember the idea of a watch? Its purpose is to tell time. Our purpose is to live in this world. And the world has been designed to enable that. In Romans chapter 1, we won't read this whole section, but Romans 1 verses 18 through 32 makes the same argument. In the beginning part of Romans 1 verse 18 and following, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. What does it mean to suppress something? Well, if you have to pass gas and you don't want to do it in a public area, you're suppressing, right? You're intentionally keeping something bottled up. And that's the idea here. You're suppressing truth. You're bottling it up. Because that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. And that's all we're going to read here. But the whole point of Romans 1 is, when you look at nature, it brings you to God. If it brings you to anything else, it's because you have suppressed what God has made evident to you, what God has made obvious to you. And who here would like to avoid the obvious? Who here would like to just ignore the obvious? Well, that wouldn't be very safe, would it? Only a fool would dispute this irrefutable truth. And that's why in Psalm 14 and other places it says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. It's because you have to ignore what is easily observable. Now, this gets applied to a lot of different things today. DNA. Can anybody tell me about the structure of DNA? Maybe one of our older guys here or ladies. Double helix. So it's basically like a staggered ladder and it twists. Kind of like a rotini noodle. Anybody here like pasta? Kind of like a rotini noodle in a sense. And it's made up of four different components, four basic components, right? A, G, T, C. Adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. So you have four basic components that work together to make us who we are. And it's really complex. Cells, the same way. Cells are really complex. Molecular machines inside of cells like lysosomes and the endoplasmic reticulum and all the different things that you might find inside of a cell are themselves irreducibly complex. You can't take any part of them out and they still work. Then you have things like blood clotting. If you couldn't clot your blood, what would happen? You fall down and you die. That's what happens when somebody has something like hemophilia. It's nearly impossible to get somebody who has hemophilia to stop bleeding. You have to pump in basically synthetic clotting sorts of things to get them to clot. And it doesn't really work as well as the normal product because they're missing something. There's a malfunction in part of their blood clotting process. I'll have a chart up in a minute. Now, bacterial movement, probably not the greatest thing that you want to think about, but I'll just say this. You have a lot of bacteria in your body and around your body. That's why it's important to brush your teeth, because you have millions of bacteria all floating around in your mouth. And they move around, and some bacteria have a little whip-like tail on them that move them around. They swim around in your body. And then you have others that have like ski poles. They kind of and move themselves around. That's how they do this. Even something as small as a bacteria is incredibly advanced. Think about the bigger systems. Then you have things like migration. We've talked a little bit about that, and others have talked about that. You know, birds, it's been kind of suggested that they follow magnetic resonance lines from the earth. Who told them to follow those lines? Even if that is how they migrate, which is kind of up for debate, even if that is how they migrate, who told them to follow that? So I'll show you a few illustrations here on the big screen. Can anybody tell me what this is? Binary code, and binary code is basically how you would do what? Make a computer. That's how computers communicate. You have two basic components, zeros and ones. Yeses and nos. You might think of it that way. So this is binary code. This has been developed by some of the smartest people of all time. People like Gottfried Leibniz, George Boulez, and Claude Shannon, and others. And it's been in the process of being developed for hundreds of years. Computers are relatively new, but binary code's been around for a long time. Two basic elements. You look at something like this, somebody programmed it. Somebody wrote this, right? A code writer, a coder would write this. DNA. So you have a binary system. This is a quaternary system. Quaternary because it has four components to it. Infinitely more complex than binary code, but somebody who looks at binary code says, hey, somebody wrote this. DNA, who wrote this? It's pretty irrefutable, right? I mean, it's way more complex than binary code for sure. Then you have something like the blood clotting cascade. You got about two dozen different steps in a blood clotting cascade. So you hurt yourself here, you trip and you fall, you stub your toe, and you start bleeding. And in an ideal world, you're going to stop bleeding, right? You put pressure on it or you stop bleeding somehow. So you have all these different factors working together. It's not like one little process, one thing leading to another. It does happen to a degree that way, but then you have other things that interact with things early on. And again, if you have something like hemophilia, this is not going to work. And if you take one of these little processes out, you will die. How does something like this develop over time? Because you have the things early on that don't have blood clotting. They get hurt, they die. One more, this is something called a plant hopper. What does that look like there? Gears. That's the signature of design. That's an iPhone 14 right there in the rear end of a plant hopper. And it synchronizes their legs just like a car transmission would work. It synchronizes it so it works appropriately. And in fact, many scientists have used things in nature to try and understand and develop technology. So the Wright brothers, what did they pioneer? They weren't the greatest inventors, but what did they pioneer? Airplane, right? The airplane. And what did they study in order to develop an airplane? Birds. One last point here, and we'll say this is the rubber mallet. A rubber mallet's like the finishing touches. You're trying to put the floor in. You're not going to use a sledgehammer. You're going to use a little rubber mallet. And so the rubber mallet is history. What we want to do is not only argue for a God. That's what nature does. Nature gives us a God. Now, it gives us a little bit more than that. Romans 1 says that we understand his invisible attributes. We understand his divine nature. We understand his power. So we get a little bit. But ultimately, what we have to do is we have to get to this historical sciences. And so just the last few points here. The scientist here is studying burn residue from the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon to try and understand that. A few points here. Researchers regularly use science to try and understand and examine events of the Bible. We have things like archaeology. We have things like epigraphy that's trying to understand inscriptions. Things like history, geology. Geologists might study waving patterns and big rock formations to understand the flood of Noah. All these things are used to evaluate the Bible's accuracy, which brings us specifically to the God of the Bible. And hundreds of years of this analysis has confirmed countless things in the Bible and has repeatedly vindicated the Bible against claims of inaccuracy. People like Belshazzar in the book of Daniel, people like the Hittites and the Horites during the age of Abraham and others, and then the existence and influence of King David. About 50 years ago, nobody believed in the archaeological world that David was real. But then we start finding inscriptions that mention David, and the Bible is upheld. Now, ultimately, we don't just want to argue for a God. We want to argue for Jesus. We want to argue for the message of the Bible. And we get to the Jesus resurrection. And that's where we start using sciences. A few years ago, they tested in the tomb of the Holy Sepulchre. They tested the stone there to try and understand if it is a first century tomb or not. And they found that it was. It's in the right vicinity. It's exactly what you would normally expect for this. So that's true whether we want to build our own faith or to awaken the sense of God's existence in another person. And I think, Ryan, you might talk a little bit about the sense of God that is within us and why we even have tools to work with in the first place. But that is probably it on time for me. We could have talked about a lot of different things, but hopefully this has given you some tools to work with. Sledgehammer, claw, hammer, and a rubber mallet. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me afterwards. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much, Eric. Appreciate that.